Mexico to Panama, where they call to each other from the underbrush. For wood thrushes, not just any woods will do. They depend on large blocks of intact forest throughout their range. Unfortunately, wood thrushes are losing habitat as humans convert vibrant forests to pastures, mines, and urban developments. As the remaining forests become smaller and scattered, the wood thrush are left with less food and more threats from predators. We can help wood thrushes and forest birds everywhere by conserving and restoring woodlands throughout the Americas. That includes planting native trees in urban green spaces and buying bird-friendly coffee that's cultivated without destroying the crucial habitats that support the wood thrush's priceless song. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support comes from Wild Delight Bird Food, offering a variety of blends designed to mimic the natural resources wild birds crave. Available at Chewy.com.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Hale and with me as usual is Brandon. To start us off, as I think most of our listeners know, we usually start with a little quote and quandary. I've got both a quote and a quandary for today. Why don't I start off with my quote to kind of get us rolling? I failed to write down where the author of this quote. I know he was a Jewish intellectual living through the mid-20th century and I believe obviously lived through or was associated with, you know, the Holocaust and the events of the Second World War and all that kind of stuff. But he had this wonderful little quote. So unfortunately, I forgot to write down his name. But the quote is simply, the ability to have the privilege of ordinary tragedies. And what I thought about that was it was a great quote in the sense that it really illustrates that there is historical periods, lifetimes, generations where we live through a kind of expectation of normalcy, and everybody within the context of a normal life goes through normal tragedies, you know, breakups, family deaths, you know, accidents, you know, issues with work or whatever it might be. But these things, as much as they're personally, often can be extremely difficult. And as he used in the quote, the word tragic, you know, there's something ordinary about being able, and almost, I think he's almost talking in a privileged sense of being able to live a life of stability and reliability where one can actually experience normal tragedies, you know, that, you know, the failure of a marriage, you know, the passing of a loved one, the failure of a career, the failure of a personal dream or whatever it might be. But that these sorts of tragedies, there are periods in time, there are epochs, generations, whatever it might be, where there's such upheaval, there's such, like, you know, chaos, destruction, whatever it might be, that suddenly these ordinary tragedies no longer have space to become relevant, right? Like, so we can think about, you know, beyond even something like World War II, another great example would be, you know, people in the Middle Ages living through, you know, the Black Death and the Plague, right? It would be another great example where, you know, suddenly you're living through, your generation is living through a period where literally 50, 60, 70% of the people around you are just suddenly dying, towns are being wiped out, your societies are collapsing. And so, in a sense, not only are you being robbed of a happy life, but you're also being, or a normal life, but you're also being, in that case, you're being robbed of being able to experience normal failures, effectively. And, you know, we don't normally think of those things as like, you know, a virtue to experience or like a good, but within the context of having those things ripped away from you, they do sort of seem to have some sort of good or normalcy or honesty about them that is deeply troubling when one's situation is so disturbed that those things are no longer available.
Two things for me here is that, one, I think the last point that you're making here is really really well considered, that what we consider usually like a tear or an interruption or a disintegration in a life is in an otherwise normal life is kind of the trough to the valley of, you know, the euphoric moments of life, the successes and whatnot, that you really do need a kind of, you need failure conditions in order to have particular, you know, success condition, but, you know, to use like really stodgy analytical terms, but that's really, that is how it is, that our life is composed of these moments that if they didn't have the possibilities to go one way or the other, well, then those just wouldn't make sense. And this goes into my second point that I thought of initially, was that it's not even that, because this is the thing, is a life where tragedies happen in an otherwise normal life, there's a narrative within which that rests, right? Like the person, they experience a tragedy, but it's at least intelligible. At least you can articulate and share it. You can say what went wrong. You can say what you were trying to do. Whereas in lives that don't just have normal tragedies, there's not just a disintegration of a particular dream or a particular relationship or, you know, your particular health or something like that. There's a disintegration of that narrative of when things go wrong per se, right? It's the disintegration of sense, of the narrative of your life, that your whole existence is thrown into, you know, totally unparadigmatic waters, that the sort of peaks and troughs that I'm talking about, they don't make sense as far as like this as a trough, as, you know, a deep point, as a tragedy. It totally, it pales in comparison to the narrative that these things are supposed to house, right? But I will say, like, there is almost something kind of like tactless about trying to redeem, you know, someone surviving the Holocaust, that, oh, you know, like, you went through this thing, but there's something that you at least got out of it, right? It almost feels kind of tactless. It doesn't sit within the narrative of, okay, well, people bounce back from things or life goes on, you know, something fundamentally disruptive has happened, right? I think this is kind of at the basis of this idea that, like, with the Holocaust, something like ontologically distinct happened, that there just was this feeling in history that something unprecedented happened. I leave that to the historians to decide whether that's historically true or not. But narratively, this is how we understand it, that you've, in a sort of as evinced by my saying, like, there's just things that don't make sense to do with that particular story, right? Like to try and redeem it or to make some kind of consolation or something like that.
Yeah, and I think with deeply dehumanizing events, whether those events are caused by other people or, you know, natural, you know, events, right? Like another thing that pops to my mind would be like, you know, the story of Pompeii and Herculaneum or whatever. Again, it's like, you know, the dehumanization, the destruction of like normal life isn't just the destruction of like goods. It's a destruction of goods and bad. Like, right, like it's not like, you know, the things matter that, like, you know, we are joyful about, and things matter that we're sorrowful about, and there are circumstances when all those things are taken from you, right? Like, you know, because of whatever those external, usually, you know, quite gigantic chaotic circumstances are, and that is a complete dehumanization, right? It's not just, you know, that you're no longer going to be like happy and blah, blah, blah. Like, you also don't get to experience the other side of the coin, and both sides of the coin make up a full, you know, and complete, you know, existence in normal human life. So yeah, I just thought that was a really like illuminating, interesting quote in terms of, you know, seeing that like life is more than just like, you know, the seeking of pleasure and like the entertaining and good moments. It is also those tragedies. Those tragedies are deeply formative, and they can be the possibility for those things to be experienced, to happen, can in a sense be ripped away as well. So my quandary for today is what's called the Publius paradox. Now, I was actually, another thing I've been listening to lately is a book. You know what the name skips my mind. It's the Generation of Rage or something like that. But basically, it's about the philosophical and intellectual backgrounds of the modern American right, MAGA movement and all this kind of stuff, but more the theorists and intellectuals and stuff behind that and that whole scene. And the Publius paradox, you know, admittedly is something that's kind of purported by by Adrian Vermeule, who's kind of like a right-wing, a MAGA-adjacent thinker, very questionable guy. Weak constitutional governments, you know, to actually give the definition, it's the Publius paradox articulated by Adrian Vermeule is a constitutional theory holding that excessively weak government can create excessive strength. When illegal restrictions are too rigid to allow for survival during emergencies, they are violated by executives, creating dangerous precedents that ultimately expand future executive power far beyond looser initial rules that would have allowed. The argument, and it's one of the problems with democracy, is we want, you know, we want weak government. The argument, one argument against having kind of like a weak or a very liberal or whatever you might say in Adrian Vermeule's case, government, is that when you don't have inbuilt structures or mechanisms for the activation of strong authority, then that strong authority will still arise, but its rising will also constitute the destruction of said, or the violation of said, you know, loose or light or liberal political structure, right? So basically the argument that people like Adrian Vermeule and such are making is that, you know, if you make a government that is actually more executively stronger to begin with, then it has confines that it can operate in such a way that it can deal with problems more directly and more quickly and more concisely, while not actually breaking down like the whole system. Whereas, you know, a weaker, constitutional government is always at risk of, you know, finding itself in a situation that it simply can't deal with due to the weakness of its governmental structure, and that therefore it lends itself to being overtaken from the inside or out by much more radical forces.
Like immediately when you started talking about the relation between like loose or like strong-handed government, or loose versus like strong-handed government, I immediately started thinking about like the politics of Taoism, that a loosely defined government or a government that isn't like ruled by strict laws or by rigid, like, to, you know, by the books rule, that's one that's more flexible. It doesn't, because it can't break, right? I mean, in the Tao Te Ching, they use the example of dead wood, right? It's completely rigid, but it's dead, and it can be rigid because it's dead. Whereas grass bends in the wind and it doesn't break because it's pliable and alive, right? But I think this is not exactly that, because on the one hand, it's not arguing for loose government in the sense of saying like, well, we need something that's pliable and that can deal with every particularity that comes up. You can't know what to do in advance, so you should leave things kind of loose. But it is saying that there is something like achieving that effect through a strong governance or through very explicit governance. That's what I seem to be hearing is the paradox, is that despite the fact that there is a multitude of things that a government needs to deal with, even though it should seem like having loose regulations or something like that will enable you to deal with those things, actually you need to have ready responses to all of those things, and that will allow you to not be overpowered because your government can actually handle these things.
Yeah, and I think it's worth saying that you know, and I'm not agreeing with necessarily Adrian Vermeil here, but it's worth saying that this is a current, very current thinker. This is someone who's operating presently and in the last 10 years and all this kind of stuff. You know, and they're, you know, arguing for strong things like stronger executive authority, especially within the context of like MAGA and Trump and all that kind of stuff, which is obviously problematic. But, you know, their argument is largely that, you know, it comes from a place of, you know, the modern world is a world that's like, that is, you know, globalized and interconnected, changing rapidly, et cetera, et cetera. And when you have a deeply legalized, like deeply legalistic, you know, very structured, like, you know, multi-layered bureaucracy that takes into account things like, you know, important things, obviously human rights and, you know, legalism and all this kind of stuff, that it's slow and incompetent to respond to, you know, very real, fast happening activities, right? Whether that be like foreign interference or, you know, the emergence of new technologies or whatever it's going to be, right? And, you know, and as these things become worse and worse and, you know, and become more and more preeminent, you end up in a situation, you know, the idea is that you'd end up in a situation where like this sort of governmental style can't function properly. It can't keep up. And this is actually like an argument that's been made by similar people towards looking at like the CCP and stuff and how they operate. You know, not necessarily advocating for a CCP style government at all, but the virtues that people have spoken about in that style of government is that, you know, there is this more rigid executive authority that is able to respond quickly because it doesn't have all the legal, it doesn't have to jump through all the legalistic rigors and hoops and courts and judgments in the same sort of way. So, you know, if a problem arises, you know, a decision can be made like immediately, right? And, you know, and the entire system can be sort of organized and shifted to deal with that problem, you know, in an immediate manner. And I think, you know, another kind of commentator was saying, you know, it's the difference in some sense between, you know, the American style of government or like the Western style of government is, you know, a government full of lawyers, it's government of laws, of legalism, whereas the CCP and government styles like that are a government full of technocrats, right? Like people who are more focused on, you know, end results and engineering and all that kind of stuff. And that, like, because they, like, and they've already built the structure, right? Like, they don't have to break out of the structure to respond to issues because the structure is already set up in such a way where, like, it's their quick response is expected as part of the system. Yeah, I thought it was an interesting, like, it's like, look, obviously it's concerning because basically the argument is that, you know, it's an argument for some level of like more authoritarianism, right? Like the virtues of an authoritarian government. But at the same time, I always think it's worthwhile to see that like perhaps there are some, I don't want, virtues is maybe not the right word, but I'll use it, like virtues to, you know, that kind of argument or whatever, right? Where you see states, I think, you know, you and I talk about technology a lot on the show and the rapidity of the development of technology in the public and within the context of the government and states and corporation, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, how slow our own democracies are to adjusting to this problem. It's only just now that, for example, in Australia, they're trying to put in laws to stop, you know, teens from using social media, or, you know, in Canada, they're putting in rules with teens not using cell phones and smartphones at school or whatever, right? But it's kind of like, it seems a little too late is the general, like, consensus. The process of trying to play catch up has been such that it's like not, you know, the state was never going to be able to respond quickly. And as well, you know, corporate entities and all this kind of stuff also have immense, you know, power and influence within that structure to slow these processes down.
That is essentially what this paradox does come down to. It comes down to an examination of the of authority in a certain way. I mean, all governments exercise certain amounts of authority. You don't have a legitimate government that doesn't have authority over its citizens or the people that it's subject to. But I think in this case, it seems to be, yeah, it does seem to be like an argument for authoritarianism. I guess my wonder in approaching this kind of delicately is to parse authority from authoritarianism, right? Like, where do we normally find unproblematic cases of the exercise of authority in government? And does that look like the kinds of cases that this paradox might be used to sort of advocate for, and try and parse out those sorts of things? That's what I would do in trying to kind of like sanity check those kinds of things.
I think that's kind of the obvious counterpoint, right? Is that, like, you know, you get giving more authority or to a more, you know, or, you know, a government leaning more into an authoritarian zone, you know, necessitates the possibility of that, you know, needle moving farther and farther, right? Like, you know, one only needs to look at, you know, today at somewhere like Russia or China or whatever, for example, where, you know, they're effectively dictatorships of one form or another. Is there this balance where it's like, oh, well, we can have more executive authority because it allows us to operate more quickly, but therefore we need to give more responsibility of action to the executive authority or to the branches of authority? If that happens, you know, what stops them from continuing to push those limits, right? So that's like the obvious counterpoint to that. I thought it was nonetheless an interesting, you know, sort of notation about, like, you know, the kind of weaknesses of the kind of neoliberal government system. And I really wanted to just talk about the nature of Aristotle and his relationship to form. I've recently been reading, you know, I've read Aristotle in the past, obviously, to a greater or lesser degree, but it's been a little while. But I've been reading Jonathan Lear's Introduction to Aristotle, The Desire to Understand, which is a quite a well-known sort of Aristotle introduction text. Jonathan Lear, I think at the time of writing this, was a professor at Yale University in classics and stuff like that. And so wrote this as sort of an intro into the general ideas. And, you know, he spends quite a bit of time in the first section talking about this idea of form. You know, I think if any of our listeners are familiar with philosophy, you know, the idea of form is especially classic, you know, Greek philosophy is going to be, you know, that's going to be a term that they've heard before. And I think, you know, most people, when they hear the term forms, they immediately think about Plato, right? Plato's, you know, the theory of the forms. Now, we don't need to get into that too much, but obviously that was a theory which posited that the forms were some kind, you know, in the simplest description, some sort of extra universal, you know, entities, right? Like, you know, they existed. The forms were the perfect, you know, instantiations of whatever, you know, entity or being, and that anything that existed in the world was some sort of imperfect reflection of said form. So for example, like, you know, the idea of the, you know, sometimes the term ideas is used synonymously with forms, but, you know, the idea that there's a perfect chair And then out in the world, you know, in the experiential world, you know, we encounter, you know, all sorts of imperfect versions of the perfect chair that, you know, are sort of reflective of, you know, that form's light or whatever. Aristotle, though, is also obviously very interested in the idea of form. However, his idea of form is much more instantiated in the individual beings themselves. It's sort of like the most primary definition, you could say, or idea of what a being kind of is. One of the, you know, main ideas that, you know, most people encounter with Aristotle, or that maybe most of our listeners would know, you know, if you kind of do any sort of pop philosophy or whatever, is, you know, that will generally come up. One of his first ideas is, you know, the idea of the four causes, that there's the formal cause, the efficient cause, the final cause, and the material cause, right? And all those things go into, you know, making any entity what it is, whether it's a human being or a chair or an elephant or a tree or whatever. You know, Lear wants to make clear, and this is something that I, you know, find really interesting, that really all these things are actually aspects of form itself. That form is actually the primary thing. So when we talk about like the form of the chair, right? Like we talk about, so for example, to break it down in the four variations that, you know, most of us are kind of used to, it's like you think about the chair and it's like the formal cause is the form of the chair, like what a chair is. A chair is a chair, right? And then you have the efficient cause, right? Like how the chair came about. Someone built the chair, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? And then you have the material cause, obviously what the chair is made out of. And then there's, you know, the final cause, right? You know, the chair is for sitting. It's, you know, for the sake of which of whatever. I think Lear wants to make it clear that actually all of these things are just form, right? Like they're not, there isn't actually this like four quadrant separation where form is just one of the four components. All of these components are actually collapsed into, you know, form itself, right? Like when a plant is, you know, grow, and this goes into potentiality and actuality, right? Like, you know, any being has, you know, the potential to be what it is through its growth, and that actualization of, you know, the growing process is the actualization of that form. But like also too, the form is found in the potential and the seed, you know, and, you know, it's also found in, you know, if the tree is used as, you know, to create a ship or a cut down or whatever, it's also part of the form in terms of like the material or a final cause of that, you know, the tree. All these aspects are all part of just form, which is found in each individual entity.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting too, because it should make a lot of sense that of Aristotle's four causes, form would have some kind of primacy, because Aristotle is trying to revise Plato's transcendent conception of form, right? Aristotle is introducing an immanent conception of form, and you know it's immanent because this principle of the four causes only applies to things that are caused to exist, right? Aristotle really is only speaking about a world where things arise and decay, whereas for Plato, what things are is eternal, right? The form of the chair isn't just a perfect representation. It's what the chair you see is. You just see it in a corrupted form because you exist in corrupted flesh, right? You were put in a body to see things from particular angles, but what that chair is perfect, but it exists in a transcendent world. Aristotle wants to temper that transcendent conception and say, well, the chair is the chair right in front of you. That chair also, however, came to be somehow, and the three other kind of causes braid themselves into the form of the chair, as it were, right? The chair's form is what it is, but it isn't that form without being constructed of some material, having been constructed by something and existing for some purpose and whatever immanent system exists.
Well, what you're starting to see within Aristotle's conception of form is this more like holistic conception. And I mentioned actuality and potentiality earlier.